reached our cruising altitude, it's time for the Flyover View.
Welcome back to Flyover View, a member of the Heartland Pod family of podcasts, and look at Heartland News from 30,000 feet. From the Gateway Arch to the Rocky Mountains, I'm your host, Kevin Smith, and I want to thank you for joining me today. I'm feeling a mite under the weather this week, folks, but I'm still bringing you those headlines. Part of my excitement today comes from putting a little bit of distance from the constant election chatter that we've had in the last few months. Not that we should forget the lessons that we're to take away from the midterms, but I honestly love this job most when I get more and more removed from what's in everyone's faces all the time and can slip into a story or two that you don't see coming. Before I start, though, I wanted to extend a thank you to Rachel for taking the time to interview me for yesterday's show. Hard to believe that Flyover View is nearly 2 years old at this point. So let's begin, folks, with an update on Agape. New allegations are now stemming from the slow-motion car crash that is the history of the Agape boarding school in Stockton, Missouri. Former students have now testified to attempting suicide as a result of the physically abusive climate experienced within the walls of the school, according to new evidence filed in civil suits against the school. In the evidence listed in the motion, three plaintiffs have said they attempted suicide at least once in their time at the school. The evidence that has come out through deposition testimony shows that Agape had a complete indifference and conscious disregard for the safety of the students. The allegations are horrific and support a claim for punitive damages, which is why we have asked this court to allow us to present evidence to the jury for a punitive damage award, says lawyer Ryan Frazier of Monsees and Mayer, who is representing many of the cases. Now, John Schultz, who represents the Agape boarding school, refuted the claims made by the students, saying, "For the past 30 years, Agape has provided over 6,000 boys with an opportunity to get their life back on track and toward a bright future," going on to claim that they had 24/7 supervision, accredited academics, vocational training, mentoring, sports, and many activities that he states the boys enjoyed. He claims that anything being said about abuse in the school is simply sensational allegations. But in the 52 pieces of evidence listed in the motion, including testimony from former students as well as staff members, over half included instances of physical abuse or inappropriate physical restraint. Robert Buckland, a name you will know well if you've been following this story with us, is listed as Plaintiff RB. While at Agape boarding school, Buckland says he was physically abused, including one instance where a staff member choked him with a hair trimmer cord. Another former student reported an instance where the staff member slammed his head through drywall, and yet another former student reported that after a suicide attempt, a staff member bashed his head into the floor, breaking the former student's nose and braces. There are also allegations that then-medical coordinator Scott Dumar cut them off of their behavioral medication, saying that, quote, God would fix them, and that they suffered bad reactions and withdrawal symptoms as a result of the abrupt discontinuation of medication. The motion states that when asked about the situation, Dumar invoked his Fifth Amendment right during deposition. Meanwhile, the state of Missouri's attempt to close Agape boarding school seems to have ground to a halt. The Missouri Court of Appeals has ordered a Cedar County judge to halt all further action in the Agape boarding school case until it issues a final decision on a recent motion. In what is called a preliminary writ of prohibition, the appellate court said the only action Associate Judge Thomas Pyle could take in the case is to vacate his October 12th order that the state appoint a guardian ad litem for each Agape student and to include all the parents as parties to the AG's petition to shut down the school. Now, Judge Pyle wants the parents to be parties to the case, and given the opportunity to be heard. Attorney General Eric Schmidt wants to block that. Now, on the interview yesterday, Rachel and I spoke on this, and we aren't yet clear on A.G. Schmidt's aim here. Personally, I'd wager it's to keep this case as under the radar as possible, with as few voices involved. But perhaps the AG office just wants the case to move forward quicker. Either way, though, this is all long overdue, and the gumming up of the process isn't exactly great to see. This school should have been shut down yesterday. Wisconsin climate plans. Wisconsin could cut its net carbon emissions to zero by 2050 and boost its economy in the process, according to reports released Tuesday by environmental and clean energy groups. The first report, titled Achieving 100% Clean Energy in Wisconsin, maps strategies for the state to reduce carbon emissions to a level that could be completely removed from the atmosphere. The second report, The Economic Impacts of Decarbonization in Wisconsin, was produced by the Cambridge Econometrics in consultation with four other organizations. It projects that reaching the net zero carbon goal could save $2 billion to $4.4 billion in healthcare costs in 2050. reduce deaths from air pollution by anywhere from 28 to 63 per million people in a year, expand the state economy by 3% or $16 billion, add 68,000 jobs, and cut fuel and energy costs for consumers. To get to net zero by 2050, state utilities must generate all electricity from clean power sources, primarily wind and solar, while also cutting fossil fuel use significantly. The proposed timeline is premised on widespread, rapid adoption of electric vehicles and carbon-free technologies such as electric heat pumps for heating and cooling buildings. The expanded electrification would increase the state's electricity demand by more than 2.5 times, and all of that demand to be powered by clean sources, and the load on gas and liquid fuel use falling to near zero. Along with policies in government and industry to encourage the transition, the report also uses modeling to project consumer behaviors that could help advance the shift, like purchasing more electric vehicles, for example. Now, folks, obviously these are reports that urge large-scale action and getting lots of people and industries on board. It's a bit of wishful thinking, but this is exactly the kind of thing that many romanticize about the American can-do spirit. When I was a kid, I was always fascinated with times in America where we revered a challenge and rose to meet it, or even just dreamed about it. Space travel, for example, or cars of the future, you know, Epcot stuff. Folks, we have the tools to do this. What we often lack is the courage. Missouri judge rules AG office under Josh Hawley knowingly violated transparency laws. Cole County Judge John Beatum determined the Attorney General's office under Josh Hawley violated the Sunshine Law by taking steps to conceal emails between Hawley's taxpayer-funded staff and his political consultants during his 2018 campaign for U.S. Senate. The emails in question were requested by the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee in late 2017. Hawley's office told the DSCC at the time that it had searched for our records and found no responsive records. But a year after the request was denied, the Kansas City Star revealed Hawley and his staff had used private email rather than their government accounts to communicate with out-of-state political consultants who would go on to run Hawley's U.S. Senate campaign. The revelation that Hawley and his staff were using private emails to coordinate with his political consultants set off accusations at the time that he had illegally used public resources to benefit his Senate campaign. But it wasn't until February of 2020 that the Missouri Auditor's Office finished its review of the matter, concluding Hawley and his staff may have misused state resources. But the widespread use of private email and text messaging in the office made it impossible to determine definitively. And folks, let's just add an aside here. When he was running for Attorney General in 2016, Hawley criticized Hillary Clinton's use of a private server for sending and receiving emails while she was Secretary of State, and then went on to do precisely that exact same thing for his Senate campaign. Now, Mark Pedroli, an attorney on the case and founder of the Sunshine and Government Accountability, praised Beatum's ruling as an enormous victory not only for transparency and good government, but also for access to critical government records during election. He states that Attorney General Hawley's office illegally concealed public documents immediately prior to a U.S. Senate election against Senator Claire McCaskill for the sole purpose of preventing damage to Hawley's campaign and affecting the outcome of the election. And keep in mind, McCaskill only lost by 5% of the vote. Concealing public records in order to prevent damage to your campaign is cheating. It deprives competing candidates of a level playing field, and it's illegal. Now, unfortunately, there won't be much of a penalty for these actions. The AG office will have to pay $12,000 in civil penalties plus attorney fees. Now, this makes me wonder, are our tax dollars paying for Josh Hawley's blunders? Is Hawley just getting off with nothing more than yet another ding to his spotted reputation? If you have further clarification on this, please hit me up, because I'd love to know. Hey there, folks. I hope you're enjoying the show. I want to remind you that we are a 100% listener-supported family of podcasts, all under the umbrella of the Heartland Pod. You can catch our flagship show, The Heartland Pod, on Mondays every week with Adam Summer, where he delivers an opening statement before being joined by Sean Diller and Rachel Parker for Talking Politics. You can also join a variety of our hosts on most Tuesday and Thursdays for Let's Have a Chat, featuring interviews with folks of interest from around the Midwest. On Wednesdays, the focus shifts to a rotating cast of special reports, like The Delta, with Nicholas and Christina Linke, and High Country, Sean Diller's Western political updates. Learn more at heartlandpod.com, and don't forget, for full access to the Last Call episodes and the Heartland News blog, sign up on Patreon as a podhead today. And now, the lightning round.
Lightning round.
12 Republican senators join all 50 members of the Democratic caucus on a vote to break a filibuster on same-sex marriage bill. I know I said I love bringing you stories that you aren't hearing nationally, but honestly, I have to start this lightning round off with the sheer levity that this story brings. A true bipartisan display of actual governance coming from the Senate. A vote of 62-37 broke a filibuster to advance legislation that protects same-sex and interracial marriage, clearing that key 60-vote threshold and putting the historic legislation on track to eventually be passed through the chamber. All 50 members of the Democratic caucus voted to start debate on the bill, as well as 12 Republicans. Now, I just want to call out the GOP senators who voted yes on this, not to detract from the Democratic senators who we all know were going to vote on this, but to honestly speak out when someone on the Republican side does a progressive good. Susan Collins of Maine, Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, Rob Portman of Ohio, Mitt Romney of Utah, Tom Tillis of North Carolina, Roy Blunt of Missouri, Cynthia Loomis of Wyoming, Richard Barr of North Carolina, Shelley Moore Capito of West Virginia, Dan Sullivan of Alaska, Joni Ernst of Iowa, and Todd Young of Indiana. Now, it's still uncertain when the same-sex marriage bill will pass the Senate. If senators don't reach a time agreement, which must be approved by all 100 members of the chamber, the final Senate votes will be pushed back until the last week of November and the first week in December. Ashcroft seeks book bans and wants your opinion on it. As of Tuesday, Missouri libraries and members of the public can formally weigh in on an attempt by Secretary of State Jay Ashcroft to block public funding for libraries if they offer books that parents feel a little bit squeamish about. Ashcroft, a Republican who is planning to run for governor in 2024, proposed the controversial new rule in October, and the 30-day comment period designed to let the public air their concerns is now in full effect. The proposed rule would require Missouri's 160 local public libraries to adopt policies on the age appropriateness of literature, and under the rule, anyone could challenge access to books. Libraries that violate the rules would risk losing state funding, which is doled out by the Secretary of State's office through the state librarian. The Missouri Library Association called the rule an infringement on the professional judgment of librarians, and an effort to further stoke division in the communities that libraries serve. The Missouri Association of School Librarians also asked residents to support libraries, public, academic, and school across Missouri, and provide feedback on this restrictive and harmful rule change. So please submit your comments to the Secretary of State's office via email at comments@sos.mo.gov, and you must include in the subject line the number 15, CSR, the number 30-200.015. Speaking of calls to action, another proposal from Ashcroft needs our voice. A proposed amendment to 19 CSR 10-15.010 will add some truly eye-opening nanny state powers. Though abortion is generally banned in Missouri, a physician may perform one in the case of a medical emergency. This amendment would require doctors to report any abortion performed and certify that it was a medical emergency. So what constitutes a medical emergency, you might ask? As laid out, it says a condition which, based on reasonable medical judgment, so complicates the medical condition of the pregnant woman as to necessitate the immediate abortion of her pregnancy to avert the death of the pregnant woman, or for which a delay will create a serious risk of substantial and irreversible physical impairment of a major bodily function of the pregnant woman. So essentially, vague as hell. So hospitals and physicians are already struggling with this definition, as the Missouri government has yet to issue any meaningful clarification of the language that carries the full force of the law. Doctors found in violation could lose their license and be charged with a Class B felony. It seems obvious to me that Ashcroft appears to be abusing his office with these two far-right issues in an effort to pad his win column before his run for governor in 2024. Public comments on this proposed amendment are open until November 30th, so use the same email strategies laid out in the book banning story before, only with this CSR title in the subject line, and let him know that we trust our professionals, be they doctors, librarians, or otherwise. Kansans say no to legislative power grab. Kansas voters have narrowly rejected a proposal to curb the power of the governor and other officials to regulate businesses and set environmental and public health rules, rebuking the state's Republican-controlled legislature again after affirming abortion rights earlier this summer. The proposed constitutional amendment would have allowed lawmakers to suspend or revoke regulations with a simple majority vote in both chambers, with no option for the governor to veto such moves. In a state that rebuked Republicans and their efforts to regulate reproductive rights and re-elected Democrat Governor Laura Kelly, is it any surprise to see voters feeling a little bit uncomfortable with giving more power to the GOP? Election Impact, Farm Bill 2023. A divided Congress doesn't necessarily spell good tidings for the 2023 Farm Bill. In the Senate, veteran Debbie Stabenow, a Democrat from Michigan, will likely lead the ag panel. She's up for re-election in 2024 and has proven a staunch defender of her interests in farm bill battles of the past, specifically specialty crops and urban farming. In the House, under Republican control, many are concerned that the Republicans will get too aggressive on altering the food stamp or SNAP program, and history shows this is not how to get a farm bill enacted. In fact, Ethan Lane with the National Cattlemen's Beef Association says, "I'm not a betting man, but if I was, I would not be placing a bet on a farm bill passing in September of 2023. He expects nutrition spending on the farm bill to be heavily scrutinized, saying further, "That's going to be a tough sell for a lot of these newly minted conservative members of Congress that are coming in to rein in spending. Some of them have been fairly declarative with us that they don't plan to vote for a farm bill, period. This is going to be a really tough dynamic." So personally, the more I look into this, the more I'm starting to agree. And I especially lament the fact that we likely won't see a bill pass with strong climate change policy either. But you can bet that I'll stay glued to this one, though. And finally, about 10,000 mink are running loose in Northwest Ohio. To start, I have to be honest. I have to admit I didn't realize the plural of mink was mink. The owner of Lion Farms USA Mink Farm in Hoagland Township, which is about 150 miles north of Cincinnati and near Ohio's border with Indiana, told the Van Wert County Sheriff's Office on Tuesday morning that someone had broken into the farm and opened cages that held somewhere between 25,000 to 40,000 mink. Sheriff Thomas Riggenbach of Van Wert County said that by Tuesday afternoon, farm employees had corralled most of the mink, but he advised residents that there were still about 10,000 mink unaccounted for. So that means they somehow rounded up 15 to 30,000 mink. According to the sheriff, he says, "I don't know that there's a significant threat to people per se, but they could attack other small animals and livestock." So yeah, folks, if you're in Ohio, be on the lookout for minks. Damn it, I meant mink. I'm leaving that in. Well, that's all the time we have this week. I want to thank you for joining us. If you have a story you feel I should look into and possibly highlight on the show, please tweet me throughout the week at Kev in Midmo or the pod's parent account at the Heartland Pod. This week's episode featured reporting and information from the New York Times, Farm Journal, Brownfield, the Associated Press, the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, CNN, the Missouri Independent, the Wisconsin Examiner, the Springfield News Leader, and the Kansas City Star. Thanks for listening.
The Flyover View is a production of MidMap Media, LLC. Learn more at www.heartlandpod.com or at the Heartland Pod on Twitter. See y'all next week.